Baggage, and it's Wednesday, 11 to 1 p.m. Central Time when we're doing this broadcast. Today, the topic of the day, we're going to get into a little bit of some of the things that we've done in the past on technologies as it relates to personal privacy. And, you know, this issue keeps cropping up in the news, keeps coming up as a, you know, significant issue, you know, among other issues as we get into this so-called war on terror. But as it strips away civil liberties, as it changes the way things work within this country and around the world, I think it's important to revisit the issue. I want to mention, too, the call-in numbers. I think this is going to be a topic that people want to get in on. So if you want to call in early at 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443 will be the number to call in on today. And I want to talk a little bit about sort of how I got involved in that issue. You know, we were researching a lot of technologies in the during the 90s, and one of the areas that kept coming up, and it would come up, you know, periodically in news reports the same way it does today. You know, the mainstream recently reported on the NSA program to monitor all of the phone calls in the United States, not so much the content, at least that's not what they've admitted to yet, but they've admitted to who you called and when you called and who was making the call in terms of the phone numbers. And, you know, they're using that as sort of a soft approach to intelligence, you know, by looking at calling patterns over huge populations and large numbers, you can start to conclude certain kinds of patterns that, you know, that then you start to look at certain kinds of individuals that receive calls from places on the planet or from individuals that are of interest. And so networks are put together and they can actually analyze, you know, that kind of data. That's why they put that together. If you look at sort of data collection generally, you know, and this is an area that's changing a lot, mainly because of the merging of communication technologies and information technologies and their efficiency. You know, it used to be, if you think about the computers of only 40 and 50 years ago, they were the size of a person's house and produced about as much as a watch, you know, today in terms of calculation and power. You know, things have gotten smaller. Things have gotten more powerful. When you look at information technology, it gets smaller and smaller and more compact in terms of how much information you can store. And when you can store a lot of data, you know, that's all great and interesting, but being able to sort it has always been the trick. And as technology has advanced in the computer sciences, the ability to sort information in huge volumes is increasing dramatically. And the projections are even more astounding. I mean, they're saying that within the next 20 years, we'll be able to compute on our desktop, for instance, as much power as a modern-day supercomputer. From the standpoint of a desktop computer, it'll be perhaps as much as a million times more powerful. Or because of the advent of miniaturization and other types of technologies related to computer science, it may be as powerful but a million times smaller. So think about that in terms of computing power, and that's sort of half the equation when you start to look at broad sweeps to personal privacy, because it takes huge amounts of computing power, not just in terms of storage, but also in terms of speed. And this is the other area where calculations can be sorted out very quickly. And what they're working on, and maybe is already even developed. Now, there was a book published a number of years ago that talked about the NSA's development of supercomputer technology. And what was happening then is supercomputers weren't a profitable business, quite frankly. The demand for those types of computing systems rested primarily with governments and huge academic institutions because of their cost. And as some of the companies started to fail, NSA came in and actually negotiated agreements to keep them in business. And we're coming to the brink, so when we come back from the break, we'll talk a little bit more about what the NSA did and where they're headed with computing power. So when we come back, this is RBN Live, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And we appreciate listeners supporting this station and supporting this program. The issue we were talking about, privacy, just before the break, I was talking about the NSA's approach to data processing and how they fund and have funded in the past a number of the larger companies that are involved in supercomputing just to keep those computers being developed. And one of the reasons is really the cost and need for that data. Now, eventually, you know, as all of these things, as technologies advance, the costs come down, the capacity goes up. You know, there's a story about NSA. It was reported back in about the middle 90s. A congressman had been driving by this building in Maryland for, you know, for years. And it's this huge building with all these massive parking lots, and he was trying to figure out what it was. And he found out it's a federally funded building, so he wanted to see, you know, what they were doing there. And it was an off-the-books project. It was over $1 billion operating budget and was part of the NSA's domestic surveillance program. And this is way before any of the 9/11 issue came up. But in, you know, in this period of time, what has happened is the thousands of people involved in NSA that work with supercomputers, they actually sort massive amounts of data, and those supercomputers are able to actually pick out things like keywords out of conversations, even things like what's called a voice print, which is something as unique as your thumbprint. It's considered a biometric identifier. In other words, something that's related to our own personal biology or physical makeup that uniquely separates us from other people. You know, people know about fingerprints and DNA, but voices is as unique as that. I mean, within a few seconds, as short as 20 seconds, you can determine who a person is exactly and with precision with the kind of material, computing materials that are available now for sorting that type of information. So you've had this sort of crunch between storing data, collecting data, and sorting the data. And the three things that kind of feed that are your computing power, your manpower, and your communication systems. And as those things have evolved, the ability to sort and monitor increasing levels of phone traffic and electronic communications traffic has also increased. And the speed, which is the key element, is on the verge of taking a jump, like going from the pencil as a word processor to a modern computer. And what's happening is this area of quantum computing, computing on such a small level where you can build these incredibly compact microcircuits. And this type of computing will speed it up so that what takes today a trillion years to sort out in terms of information being sorted out or calculated, a trillion years today will take less than an hour with that leap. And people are expecting in the computing industries these leaps to be made within the next decade. Perhaps they already have been. You know, this kind of research has been ongoing, and when that leap gets made, then all the data and all the data storage types of data banks, and we'll talk a lot about those over this next 2 hours, will be available and be able to be sorted and patterns established that really change the complexion of privacy and at the same time change the complexion of how government and private industry comes at us in terms of their messaging. And, you know, here's the other thing. With NSA, you know, we've heard, you know, this is for our own good and it's about safety and security. Something that will come of this is because of the nature of this sort of broad surveillance, a lot of the stupid criminals, quite frankly, are going to get caught because, you know, they used communication systems thinking that they're private and they're in fact not private. People like Osama bin Laden, the first thing he did is junk the electronics. He got rid of the cell phones. He got rid of the radios. He got rid of anything that created a signal that could be picked out of this mass of signals. And this is our capability today. We're able to pick up a cell phone. Cell phones all have built-in GPS, but as unique as, you know, their global cell phones have GPS. I mean, all of these instruments have built-in circuits as well as just the very signal themselves are unique enough to be picked out by telecommunication systems. They're unique enough to be picked out by anyone looking for those signals. Now, when you think about sort of data collection again, you know, you look at what are the things that are, you know, that are being collected on individuals. Certainly all of our health and medical records through insurers and hospitals are being kept track of. Those supposedly are safeguarded, but, you know, we've all seen enough news stories to know how safe data is these days. Credit card companies, purchases, discount cards at stores, all of the different financial transactions that go through your bank accounts. I mean, recent stories in the last few weeks dealing with the wire transfer centers for the SWIFT what are called SWIFT transfers in Europe. And anyone who's done any international wire transfers knows that, you know, in most of the world, that's a pretty routine kind of activity. In the U.S., country-to-country wire transfers for average citizens are a little unique because we're not so compact as Europeans. But the SWIFT system is where all of those accounts are cleared between all of the member or associated banks, so banks can move money from one location or another instantly. This system in Belgium has been really compromised in the sense of banking privacy, which, you know, may not mean much to people in the U.S., but in Europe it does matter. You know, banking privacy and the things that come from the lack thereof, they've experienced in their history, and their governments are a little different than ours, so it's important to them. So we've breached that system, but we've had a system that existed much longer than that, and it was it's a program called SINFIN, which is a criminal financial surveillance network that's put together by the U.S. government, and it's the cooperation of IRS, commercial banks, basically stock brokerage houses, anyone that transacts financial kind of information or transfers money around. And they use this system for drug traffickers, terrorists, and terrorists now is a big one in the news, but it's not something new. It's something that has been around long before 9/11. We published a book called Earth Rising, the Revolution that I co-authored with my deceased colleague, James Roderick. And, you know, that book, we actually talked back in 2000 about all of these surveillance systems that were starting to emerge, taking big steps forward, and no one was really paying attention until after 9/11. And when we came back at this issue again after 9/11 and produced a follow-on book on this same set of topics called Earth Rising 2, and in that we talk about surveillance technologies and sort of the next steps and what's coming. And one of the things that we did in all of these discussions, you know, the citations are there. You know, there's over, in those two titles, there's over 1,000 quoted sources, mostly mainstream media, academic studies, military reports, and the like. And one of the things that came out that we thought was pretty interesting is a company had actually developed, Hitachi actually had developed a micro circuit. Now, this is a circuit that could be used for, you know, embedding a little bit of information or triggering all kinds of things. You know, they use them in tags for when you go in and out of stores, you know, for security reasons. You can use them for even more information. You can use them for medical information, store a lot of information on individuals. You can use them for GPS, geographical positioning systems, and those are those are what you have built into your cars that allow you to navigate, or in your you know, your little GPS systems navigate through town and know where everything is because you're interacting with a satellite. And little microcircuits can now do this. Well, they've developed one that they believe they're going to get down to the cost where it'll be efficient enough to actually sew into the fabric of money. And the idea here is to create a live, serialized system so that whenever you transact currency, not only is the transaction tracked, but every time that dollar moves, literally from the printing press of the mint or the treasury all the way through the economy, every step of the way, and then consider that from the standpoint of personal privacy. You know, and this is, again, people say, well, you know, privacy, why is it such a big deal? You know, I mean, it's, I don't have anything to hide. And that may be true today in terms of how things work, but in every historical change in governments, privacy is always the way in which, the route in which tyranny takes the place of freedom and democracy. And I think that's what we forget, is it's not so much what you're personally doing today, but is the government in place today going to agree that what you're doing today is all right? I mean, we've seen it in every regime that's ever fallen and a new one risen. They've always used information and your attitudes, your belief systems against you. And this is where I think we need to look at personal privacy from the standpoint of, you know, what is legitimate for government to know? What is considered fair for government to know within a system of laws and a backdrop of technologies that are changing. I mean, it's not just a guy coming to your door and knocking anymore. Your threshold, the door of your household, extends past into your digital doorway where every bit of information from our birth to our death and everything in between is recorded on increasing levels and more accessible. And with that accessibility is a requirement for safeguards that flat aren't in place now and are jeopardizing people to huge risks. I mean, the biggest crime in America, technology crime, that didn't even hardly exist except in really rare instances, identity theft, all based upon the availability of data and the misuse of data as it relates to our credit or our personal assets or any number of things where identity has become a commodity to be sold and traded by criminals. And, you know, when you look at sort of the way in which all of this data is being used, you know, we keep getting the revelations from our government about our safety and security, and that is always the argument. After the break, we'll get more into that issue. And again, we're on RBN Live, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich. And you're back with Dr. Nick Begich in Changing the Way We See the World. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 till 1 p.m. on Central Time. And today's topic is technology. We're getting into some of the issues dealing with personal privacy this morning, and we're going to be covering that issue a little more as we go through the day. You know, NSA was the subject of a lot of news reports recently in terms of their surveillance activity. And, you know, we were following this again before 9/11. And, you know, I want to mention the books again that I'm working with today. They're Earth Rising, The Revolution, and Earth Rising 2. And people interested in getting more information on those books, I want to give a toll-free number and also a website. It's the toll-free number, and we'll give it again later in the program, is 888-690-1277. Again, 888-690-1277. And the website is earthpulse.com, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com for more information. But here's the quote I want to use this morning. One of them is, and it was actually reported back in 1999 on a program on ABC News, and it was called Big Brother is Listening. And this is what it says, and I quote, and it's from United States Representative Bob Barr was making the comment. He's a Republican from Georgia, and he said, and I quote, that the National Security Agency intercepts Americans' misses is clear. I have a problem with what the program appears to be doing, and that is invading the privacy of American citizens without any reason, any court order, without any reasonable cause, without any probable cause, almost a dragnet invasion of privacy, unquote. Now, when Representative Barr actually said that, and he has been one of the most outstanding critics, that was 1999, 2 years before 9/11. And certainly, 7 years ago, this activity was going on, and our mass media acts as if it's a new story. You know, the story's been out there, and the fact is the problems have continued to create problems. And, you know, when you look at technology generally and you see sort of the trends in which it's going, and then you ask yourself, what would they do with that information is really the question. And we'll get into that again as we go on, but I want to talk about NSA and sort of where some of their activities started. You got to go back, all the way back to World War II. And right after the war, we entered into an agreement with Canada, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, where we agreed to share what was called then signal intelligence. I mean, signal intelligence is anything that goes over the airwaves or through telephone lines or now internet networks or fax machines. It's really electronic communication is signal intelligence. That's how we would refer to it today. When you look at what they agreed to do was they agreed to monitor each other's communication. In other words, because in the United States, theoretically under our Constitution and the constitutions of some of these other participating governments, you can't just go in on a wholesale basis and invade people's privacy. But what we can do is sort of look the other way as our surrogates, as our those acting on our behalf go ahead and do that for us. And we've been doing that in the United States since the late 1940s. As a consequence, and, think about it back then. I mean, for those who have been around a while, in the 1940s, having a telephone was a rare thing. You know, a lot of people didn't have them. You know, there weren't television sets in everybody's home. People listened to radio. I mean, everything was different in terms of communication. Computers weren't around. They didn't even have anything even remotely. This was science fiction in those days. I mean, the fact is, it was easy to monitor a few communications around the planet with a few people. Today, it's impossible without these types of supercomputers and huge amounts of staff. Now, what Echelon has evolved to, and this is one of the reasons we were writing about it in the late 90s, is Echelon has evolved to a situation where now they monitor all these communications and all of the agencies that cooperate with these governments. So in terms of all the governments combined, these five governments that cooperate, there's 300 agencies within those governments that submit what are called dictionaries. And these are word phrases, which is kind of, you know, the way we think about dictionaries, but it is also not just word phrases on the written word or spoken word. It's actual voice prints. Specific individuals' voice profiles are also considered words in that dictionary. So people like Osama bin Laden or others that they want to track, if they're really on the phone, you know, like these voice recordings that come in for these radio networks that these terrorists use from time to time, and they say it takes days to analyze the voice, it's nonsense. Their own literature says it takes moments. Within 20 seconds, you can identify those voices. They know specifically and exactly. It's all the background information that they get off of those tapes that they're analyzing as well, which is important. But when you look at communication monitoring, that massive monitoring that has taken place essentially since World War II, it's the curves, it's the cross of how much data can the computer sort out before it's handed off to an individual person, a living person, to start to analyze and look at that data and then start to come to the kind of conclusions people come to that computers, at least at the present time, can't get to. But that's changing. And the reason it changes is the more sophisticated the computer and the programs and the speed, the more closely to what a human can do, a computer can do. You know, and it's even getting to the point, actually, where biological computers are being developed, where they have been able to fuse brain cells to electronic substrates in order to find that route to quantum computing, a route human beings already experience. The music's coming up. We're going to the break. This is RBN Live. This is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're talking about personal privacy and privacy-related technologies today. And the call-in number, if you'd like to call in and participate in this conversation today, it's not just one way, it's two way. So you're welcome to call at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443 for callers. You know, we were talking just before the break again about the NSA and sort of their approach to surveillance. You know, this issue, you know, when we started following it, it was primarily because of the Echelon program, the program we were talking about just before the break, that is really set up with the cooperation of others to monitor all the communications. And so, you know, what we heard in the recent news reports, you know, an Echelon, let me go back for a minute. You know, Echelon isn't something that just shows up in some esoteric, unheard-of newspapers. You know, it shows up everywhere. There's a lot of concern about this. It was even a story on privacy that was actually published in, of all places, National Geographic back in November. It was either 2003 or 2004. You'll find the issue. It's a great deal in terms of article and revelation from mainstream media even about some of these technologies. But what Echelon was getting a lot of notoriety for back in the 90s was it had been discovered that information collected by our intelligence agencies was being provided to U.S. corporations, and the French actually discovered this. A gentleman in the European Parliament became very incensed with the whole idea, and it was a guy named Glenn Ford, and we had gone over to see Mr. Ford, and unfortunately weren't able to make that final meeting, but they did act on this issue. And what they did is they took on the Echelon project from the standpoint of, you know, what were you really looking for? Because here you were using commercial, private information for commercial advantage to domestic companies, something that certainly angered our traditional allies, the French in particular at that time, and the British were pretty upset. The Germans shortly thereafter discovered by their own inquiries that Echelon listening posts had been constructed within military installations within Germany by the United States. And, you know, they weren't part of this agreement. The Germans have a much different view of personal privacy and how it can be misused than many Western Europeans. And so as a consequence, the Germans told them, you know, get out. And they had to take those facilities down and move them back to Great Britain, still monitoring everyone's communication. So this latest revelation that's made the press lately about financial transactions being looked at is of even deeper concern to Europeans. And you have to have the history. You know, where this, where those financial records take place is in Brussels, the very place that Glenn Ford, as a European parliamentarian, meets and takes care of his business. You know, the fact is, the issue of privacy in Europe and for the European Parliament has been big news for over a decade, way before this so-called war on terror ever began. And the reason the privacy issues were of such great concern is mainly because of U.S. technologies expanding in this area and being misused. And so a number of reports came out of the European Parliament. We quote lengthy sections of those reports in the book Earth Rising and Earth Rising 2. And what they show is how the information is not only used for commercial purposes, but the kinds of things that the U.S. government was doing with it back in the 90s. And let me just give you another another citation. And this comes out of, a major European parliamentary document. Here's what it says. Much of this technology is used to track the activities of dissidents, human rights activists, journalists, student leaders, minorities, trade union leaders, and political opponents. Well, I think everybody who's listening to this fits one of those descriptions. You know, we've always, in this tradition of American politics, had the right to disagree with government or be one of those that disagrees or opposes some policy of government. And I think everybody in the country has done that at one time or another. That doesn't mean that we're bad people. In fact, that's what invigorates the public debate, the kind of discussion that we can still have on radio today. I mean, I'm talking about the National Security Agency and their interference with personal privacy and liberty. And it's something that people should be talking about because these are government agencies. This is a government of the people and by the people, theoretically, that has changed to one for corporate interest, by corporate interest, using even our intelligence agency to further those corporate interests. You know, you got a corrupt bureaucracy to go with a corrupt political structure that really is in need of reform to remember where that government springs from, and it springs from the will of the people. You and me, listening to this broadcast, we're the ones that make the difference, and this year is another opportunity to do it. You know, it's an election year. People have given up. A lot of people have given up and don't even bother to pull a lever anymore. The reality is it doesn't take a mass movement to change things, and we have processes, orders of law, and civil methods to do that. We still have a ballot box that still can matter, and there's some things happening there. Obviously, you've heard it on many programs about what's going on with the ballot box, but it isn't over yet, and I think we need to make sure that we recognize when very few people vote, and those of us that do make a much bigger difference. You know, if only 10% of the people voted, only 5% could decide the issues with one extra guy kicked in. You know, apathy can actually be our ally in trying to make change. Where people have given up, those of us that reactivate and can engage the political debate can actually begin to reshape it and maybe, just maybe, take a piece of this thing back. You know, when you talk about NSA's abuses, you know, these aren't new. You know, these cycle about every decade or two or three, sometimes even longer. You know, the last big scandal that follows the same parallels of today was back during the Nixon administration, the late 1960s and early 1970s, the time when my father was a member of the 92nd Congress, was right in the middle of the whole Watergate situation. And I remember, you know, sort of what was happening then, and when you look at the literature and you find out, it's the same thing that's happening now. Mass surveillance programs with the technologies available, predicated on the fear of some enemy somewhere that we had actually created. You know, when you think about that whole Cold War scenario, and we never sold any tanks to Russia after World War II, but we sure did build a lot of iron factories and provide a lot of technology for efficient mining operations to protect and provide food and wheat from the early 1970s after the Nixon visit, which propped that government up and allowed them to stay in the game an extra couple of decades while the national debt quadrupled and quadrupled again to the point where our next great-great-grandchildren will still be paying it off, something that could have been avoided by a slight change in public policy that would say, hey, corporate interests don't represent the mainstream American interests. American values do, and if we apply American values to our principles of foreign relations, maybe we won't do business with governments that oppress their people and allow their own people to make decisions about what happens within their governments. But, you know, this is a kind of discussion that makes bureaucracies uncomfortable because they do have a mission. You know, NSA has a national security mission, and they're sort of the paid paranoids in the government because we got to pay somebody who looks at the worst possible scenarios, but we have to moderate that by open government, by political leadership that recognizes that the baseline values of Americans get protected first, and that when those values are in jeopardy, it's not the bureaucracies that are called to bring them back into balance. It's you and me and our political leadership that we allow to exist. And I think that's, again, where at least in this country we can still have these conversations, support these kinds of radio networks where we can have a conversation about political change based upon what's good for people, based on values we share in common, not these issues that we get hacked up over every election year. The big issues, the economic issues, the issues that dictate where our national resources go are the issues we need to start paying attention to, because we are now have great responsibility as individuals within this government, within this democratic republic, because we are the most powerful system in the world. Not since the Roman Empire has such a power existed, and we as individuals within this government have to make sure our government reflects those values that's founded this country, and we're here in the hearts of every human being. You know, national security is important. This balance between security and transparency, you know, has been out there. And safety and security is always a big issue. You know, when you go back to every time that we've been faced with conflict, you know, there's a certain time when you sort of say, okay, we'll give up a little bit of privacy for a period of time as long as we know it's coming back. But right now, we're not seeing that. We're seeing long-envisioned dreams of control and surveillance being activated because of fear. And if you go back to documents being written and published and released back in the 1980s, there was one in particular, and it dealt with this issue of new technologies and how they would change everything in terms of warfare, communications, and all of these issues were coming up. And a paper was published by the U.S. Army War College called The Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War. I got that wrong. It's the RMA, Revolution of Military Affairs. Yeah, I got it right. Conflict Short of War. And what that was about was the idea of technology changing so dramatically that much of it was going to challenge our value system in terms of privacy, in terms of security. And so there was an argument being made that as long as we violate the Constitution outside of the boundaries of the United States, somehow that would be okay. In other words, what we couldn't do in the United States because of our Constitution, they were beginning to construct the rationale for how they could do it outside of our boundaries so we could send our military or our intelligence organizations to some other country where maybe they allow torture and we don't. You know, this is a fallacy. You know, everyone who represents this government represents each and every one of us that live here, and those values that we believe our governments are trying to spread to the rest of the world aren't about shipping people around in private airplanes to places and governments that can use a cattle prod on them. It's not to ship them off to Cuba to a base. I mean, who, before all of this nonsense and the common knowledge, who the heck knew the U.S. had a base in the middle of Cuba? And we got to go to Cuba to put people for 3.5 years without being able to see any form of communication. I don't think that's right. I mean, there are terrorists there, and there's probably a whole bunch of farmers there, too. You know, the idea that national leaders that are taken down by this government or forbidden from talking to the press for national security reasons, because they'll tell. You know, Noriega is sitting in a jail down in the southeast. He can't even have a media interview. You know, you take a look at these guys that we keep toppling from power, and the reason they were in power in the first place has everything to do with our government interfering with their domestic politics and making people mad. And then we install these guys who have no value systems similar to ours and wonder why they betray our trust later. Well, you can't deal with the devil and expect anything different. Osama bin Laden, CIA trained him to never get found by the Soviets, so we can't find him. You know, it makes sense to me. You know, I mean, we got good people in these agencies that know what they're doing, yeah, and they just need a little bit of a throttle to make sure that we don't have them going out of line. You know, when we look at Iran, Iraq, you got to go back to the Shah of Iran from the 50s when the CIA put him in power. Well, he was oppressive. He tortured his people. He jailed hundreds of thousands over the course of his time. They finally rebelled and got even a more oppressive government in place that we didn't have any control over. And so what did we do at that point? We backed Saddam in Iraq, because Iraq and Iran were at war. We didn't want Iran to overrun the Middle East. So we slept with another devil. And the result is, you know, here we are with 2,500 American men and women dead, 25,000 returned, permanently disabled. And for what? For oil and gas, you know? And at the same time, the excuse using fear as the backdrop, we're becoming the most closely monitored society and culture ever to exist on the planet. Heck, we already are. And it's getting to the point where virtually you're going to be a transparent person, while governments that look into our lives are going to continue to become more and more difficult to look into, more and more difficult to understand, and more difficult to assert our power as individuals within democratic republics. And you know, when you go back again to NSA and technology, you know, here's one of the themes that showed up in that early paper by the U.S. Army War College, was this idea that, you know, what are the big targets? They decided that the big targets would be terrorism. This is from 1989, terrorism and international drug trafficking, and that these technologies that were advancing, although they even in the paper say, hey, they fly in the face of the U.S. Constitution and American values, so what are we going to do? First they had the argument about, well, it's outside the country, so we can do what we want. Then they make the argument, well, why don't we change American values? Now this got really interesting to me, because the idea of the U.S. Army War College training American officers eventually on how to change American values is not what any agency of the U.S. government should ever be about. It's not about them changing values. It's about reflecting American values. And in this case, using a backdrop of fear, which is what they say in this paper, fear will break down the ability of the American people to say yes or no. And what American people will do, and this is what that paper says, is default to safety and security and say, do whatever you need to do, just save us from ourselves or save us from this impending threat. And if you look at what's happened since 9/11, the opportunity when it presented itself was exploited by every agency in the government to bring about exactly what they had waited for, an opportunity where the mass of the American public would be gripped with enough fear to look the other way long enough to slide into the gate. And it has. When you look at surveillance technologies and how they're being applied and advanced, when you look at how they're being miniaturized and this increasing level of fear, I mean, consider drug trafficking and international terrorism. They've tied those two together. I mean, you see it even in public service announcements today. The fact of the matter is, tying those issues together has also really confused the matter, because, you know, think about it. International terrorism as a instrument of death in the United States has killed over the last 10 years perhaps 5,000 people, and that includes everyone who's died in the war. That's a lot of people, and that has devastated a lot of families. But when you compare in that same decade of 5,000 deaths, America medical malpractice, according to Harvard, is responsible for killing 1 million people over that same 10 years. 1 million people, and you hardly hear anything in the news about it. And we certainly don't spend $1 trillion trying to figure out how to solve the problem, although $1 trillion would solve half of those deaths, because the data banking already available on all medications, because most people who die of medical malpractice actually die of drug interactions, and if all that information were properly monitored by computers that can track your medications and safeguarded for privacy, the computer could tell what a doctor will never know, which drugs cause death when they interact. Hey, we're going to go to a break. We're going to come right back, and this is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And during the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the issues of personal privacy again, and sort of how that it really is a double-edged sword. You know, we're talking about technology sort of in the misapplications, what people do that kind of angers some of us and gets others excited, you know, and the idea of new technologies advancing. You know, when you talk about surveillance technologies and called data collection, what's now being termed for data collection is data warehouses, and where information is stored, huge amounts of information is stored. Not that it can be sorted maybe efficiently today, but recognizing that that capacity will exist in the future. When you think about that, just before the break, we were talking about a little bit about some of the impacts of technology and as it relates to surveillance. But think about the idea of your medical prescriptions. I mean, if those could be monitored properly by computers, because of the way doctors from all different different departments of hospitals, even within the same institutions, often will create drug interactions that, unless you're literally a computer on your head, you cannot possibly sort out all of the possibilities and drug interactions and those kinds of things. But computer-driven systems could do that, at least to a certain level. It probably eliminate about a third to half of the medical malpractice cases in the country. You wouldn't have to cap people's benefits. You just got to put the money back into the things that can actually monitor those things that cause the problems in the first place. And again, technology itself is sort of neutral. It's not the airplane or any other technology that's good or bad. I mean, think of the airplane as delivering you from point to point, from flying you from city to city, and what a great thing that is, or getting your mail from point to point. Well, the plane can also be used for dropping bombs. You know, I mean, it depends on the operator. The technology is neutral. And these evolving technologies, when you talk about supercomputing, you know, what are the other things that come out of that? When you think about translation, you know, language translation, where I can talk within the next 10, 15 years, I should be able to talk on telephone and have my voice translated into any language in the world instantly, where I can have a conversation in real time with anyone in any language on the planet. That's what's coming with supercomputing. Now, going back to this whole issue of surveillance-related technologies, it goes beyond just looking at the databases, and how databases and how information is used is really sort of where this thing goes. And, you know, we're going to be talking about that a little bit more in the next hour. I want to give the call-in numbers, too, for the next hour. It's 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. And for information, more information on the subjects we're covering, you can go to my website at EarthPulse, EARTHPULSE, EarthPulse.com. And this is Dr. Nick Begich, and we're on RBN Live today. This is a program we're doing every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And, you know, let people know, you know, pass the word on if this program is meaningful to you and you're getting good information. Let people know about it. Shoot me an email and let me know that this is the topics that we're covering or topics you're interested in. If there's other issues you want covered on this program that are technology-related, we'll do our best to get those to you. And if you want to call in the next hour, it's 800-313-9443. And you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich, and we're headed for the break. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 to 1. We've been covering the topic of personal privacy-related technologies today. And I want to give the call-in number again for those that might want to get in a question or two or a comment on the information we're covering today, 800-313-9443. And again, that's 800-313-9443. And we really appreciate the calls. It generally brings up things I'm forgetting as we go through this. You know, we've been doing this program now 5 or 6 weeks, and I'm kind of getting used to the idea of not being interviewed. You know, for years, for the last 12 years, I've done radio programs around the world, and it's a whole different deal being on the other end of the mic where you're actually being asked questions and you have that kind of dialogue. And radio is an interesting medium because you don't really get the kind of feedback you do in a public forum or in a lecture environment where you know whether you're connecting. And I think we're connecting on these issues. But if there's questions or things that come up, often what happens is it stimulates those things that I forget because I don't really use a lot of notes in the course of these conversations. In fact, this morning, deciding what we were going to do, it was decided a couple minutes before we went on the air that this was probably the issue of the day because it is getting quite a bit of media recently. You know, we've heard about the SWIFT wire transfer monitoring going on in Europe. That's the U.S. Push for, again, monitoring transactions. You know, and we're hearing about the NSA's work in domestic surveillance. And, you know, all of these things really start to come together because here's some of the problems that are being created for us to go solve, because I really believe they're being created and amplified in a way that utilizes fear for people to say, okay, we'll do that. That's okay. We can do that with these people because, after all, you know, they're who they are. And so here's where we're seeing it creep in. Everyone knows about ankle bracelets and parolees. You know, they're these little things they put around their ankles so we know where they are at all times, and they can be monitored very efficiently now with GPS. Well, now with microcircuits, these can actually be implanted under the skin so you can track their movements. This could even be done in a way where they weren't even aware they had been implanted. You know, if it were done in conjunction with vaccines, as an example, which is going to come, because miniaturization, the idea of being able to reduce the size of electronic circuits, this is, again, dealing with this whole area of quantum computing, of nanotechnologies, the miniaturization of technologies that are really changing everything. And in fact, MIT had a medical microcircuit developed over 5 years ago now that is the size of the first number on the date of a U.S. dime. I mean, this is like less than a millimeter across. You know, this type of technology, as it gets smaller and smaller, becomes easily implantable. And then here's the thing about that as well, is people say, well, your body might reject the material, et cetera, et cetera. You know, generally they figured out ways to avoid that, but there's also some big breakthroughs in genetic research where they're actually developing and have, in fact, created even brain cells, even been able to grow brain cells in the lab, been able to grow the neurons, which are sort of the wires in terms of biology. Those are the connections that transfer information from one cell to the other. You know, when you start to look at that combination, where you have actual brain tissue being embedded on the substrate of an electronic circuit board and being able to properly interface. Now, that has incredible possibilities for people with brain injuries, as an example, being able to see full recovery. But it also, quite frankly, has a lot of room for abuse. And this is, again, where it's not the technology, it's how we direct the use of the technology, and whether or not we ever even have the conversation in the first place. You know, technology doubles, and I've said it, I think, almost every program. It doubles every 9 to 10 months from the invention of the wheel to where we are at the moment. And so understanding the impact of technology is, in fact, a challenge for all democratic people, all people, in fact. And we're going to the break, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich on Changing the Way We See the World, RBN Live. And we're coming back, and this is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we are here every Wednesday from 11 till 1 p.m. Central Time, so please pass the word on, have your friends listen in. If this show is interesting to you, you can call in and ask a question or make a comment at 800-313-9443. Today's topic we're dealing with is the issue of privacy-related technologies and sort of where all of this is going. And we've covered a lot in the first hour. One of the other areas I really want to get into is more sort of how does all this coalesce, or how do these steps and what they've taken, where do you see them going? And the big issue is, again, you know, monitoring movement. I mean, if you think about that as a way to keep track of people, your cell phone, which now is probably the most widely owned common communication instrument on the planet, you know, just about to the point of the telephone. You know, we're getting really close where all the landlines are going to be way, way overshadowed by cell phones. And, you know, they actually have built in this GPS capability. Every time you have one with you, you can be located with precision within a few feet of your location or within a few meters. And, you know, this is not just on your cell phone. It's built into most new cars have a GPS capability. These are very cheap. Again, a lot of the things driving whether or not the technology is going to be used is whether or not it's inexpensive enough. And as these circuits get smaller and cheaper to make, the use of them increases as well, and we see that. You know, cameras are another example. You know, I have a camera that someone gave me in a lecture recently where the actual camera is the lens itself is about a millimeter and a half across. I mean, that is an extremely small a camera, you know, in terms of the lens. And you get, you know, great resolution. You know, when you look at the circuit behind it, this one's a fairly large one. It's about a half an inch square. But the fact is these can be reduced to a tenth of an inch cubed. I mean, that is a teeny tiny little circuit. And at that size, the price for mass producing those goes to just about nothing, where you could literally put a camera in every corner of every nook and cranny of every country at some point. And you could embed cameras on virtually anything cheaply. You know, this is, you know, each of these steps is a step along a road that as we watch it happen becomes increasingly more intrusive. You know, when you think about implants on prisoners, you know, people go, hey, maybe that's not a bad idea. You know, a child molester gets an implant, and every time he walks into a neighborhood, the light goes off. You know, some people might think that's a great idea. And it may be, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, again, I think technology is neutral. How we use it becomes important. But here's the steps that start to go from there. You know, then it's, okay, my senior is, you know, my grandparents or my parents are getting elderly where, you know, I want to keep track of them. They're getting Alzheimer's. You know, they're getting to the point where their mental faculties are going. And now you're hearing discussions of microchips being used with our elderly. Children, because of the fear of kidnapping, you know, parents are starting to look at this. You know, previously, this was reserved to heads of state. In the Attorney General's office of the government of Mexico, over 200 people have been implanted with GPS chips to track their movement, supposedly to root out corruption. But, you know, when you start with various groups of people for various good reasons, it migrates generally into the whole population. Now, the biggest crime in America, I said it in the last hour, is identity theft. The biggest excuse in America for absolute positive identification possible through either a DNA sample connected to your microcircuit so that it's absolutely you, perfectly you. That kind of ID is what's going to be pushed, and it has been pushed in the past. Every time we turn around, they try and slide it into a piece of legislation and shove it on the American population. These are all systems designed to use fear to give up civil liberties and freedom. Ultimately, what happens if it isn't the democratic government that we think we have, but some tyrant that decides that his direction or some national disaster has created a situation where one day in this country martial law gets declared? And it can happen. I mean, there was actually a press report coming out of Louisiana. It was right during the middle of that disaster that, in fact, it had happened. Turned out the press report was wrong, but we were on the edge at that instant. You know, will we be there again? The answer is yes. And then that's when whoever's in charge, regardless of what they're about, or their bureaucracies below them and the cronies that exist there, decide to do this stuff, decide to activate these systems. One of the other places is fear in terms of money transfer. The reason that they're looking at microcircuits for currency is it's a good way to end up collecting back and tracking all of those dollars that have fed narco-terrorism. You know, but you know, a lot of those concepts are created. Narco-terrorism, you know, that's a brand new word that's in the minds of every American that didn't exist 5 or 6 years ago. Unless you read government papers that are non-classified and released that talk about using those concepts to inject fear into the population like the Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War. And you can find that paper, it's the U.S. Army War College publication, 1989 or 1990, and you can look it up yourself. You know, it's out there. The, you know, the fact is, you know, when you start to look and unravel it, and this is what we've done at Earth Pulse for the last 12 years, is we built a database where we have screened out over 200,000 documents and books and articles, academic studies, and reduced it to about 20,000 that we have in our library. And of that, 4,000 have been classified and indexed. You know, that is a lot of material. And after screening a couple hundred thousand records, we reduce it down to a cohesive set of quotations and sources and patents and history that start to take these technologies and put them in perspective so that we can look at them against our value systems and against our future progress, because these are the technologies that are going to empower, either empower people in the 21st century to take control of not only what they're individually capable of, which is what I think it really is all about, but also to be able to push forward and do some really remarkable things with this technology. Or we're at that same threshold that says these technologies will be turned against us and create the most directive and controlled culture and society that the planet has ever seen. And we're at the crossroads. This generation gets to decide and gets to activate a change that is going to be so profound, because these technologies also open the door for incredible human potentials and to solve some of the big problems that have haunted mankind for centuries, from energy issues, food production, increasing intellectual power, the health technologies and the health areas. What we're seeing is the discoveries being made primarily to develop in the military-industrial complex. A whole different set of priorities exist, but the money, the trillions being spent around the world on research into human health, human physiology, computing, all of these things that is held classified away from the general public, and yet killing systems are developed, monitoring systems are developed, control systems are developed, that if we took a look at what these systems could do and we had operators behind them with the value systems most of us share, we would see a much, much different outcome. And, you know, when you look at NSA's history, it's been a history of secrecy and ultimately abuse. Central Intelligence Agency has gotten, you know, their share of bad press for surveillance over the years. And I was contrasting, you know, the 70s to today. You know, in the 70s, there was a report. It was called the Report to the President on CIA Activities Within the United States. It was issued in June 1975, after the Watergate events. And the, you know, and for those who don't remember, it was a couple of so-called ex-CIA guys that broke into the Watergate in the first place. What people don't know is after Watergate, the guy brought in to clean up the CIA for the things that the presidential report and the presidential committee had determined they'd been infiltrating domestic groups, peace groups, groups that were involved in student campuses, groups involved in civil rights. Any group they felt were opposing the status quo of American policy, just like what is happening today. They were caught intercepting mail and communications. They were caught essentially doing domestic spying without the mandate to do it. CIA is not allowed to do that. The FBI's job is to do that illegal spying for them, which actually they did. They got in a lot of trouble for it, too, in those days. J. Edgar Hoover was notorious for this. In fact, my dad was involved, as I said, in the Congress in those days. He was a member of the 92nd Congress. Hale Boggs, congressman from Louisiana, just 6 months before he disappeared on a flight here in Alaska with my dad, had called for the resignation of J. Edgar Hoover because of the corruption of the FBI and that they were monitoring all of the congressional offices. And Hoover was using that information essentially to blackmail the Congress to get his policies passed and to secure his own position, because he was afraid that he would eventually be thrown out and run the FBI forever. These agencies in the 70s were doing the same thing that they're being caught today doing, only now under the guise of some mandate or sanction because of this international war on terrorism. And the reality is, it's another one of these war on something that nothing's ever going to get done and we're never going to win. because it's not a war against a state. You know, it's not a war in the traditional sense. It's a war about ideas. And, you know, in this democratic republic since its founding, we've been at a war over ideas, you know, and just depends on whose end of that deal you're on to decide whether you're the terrorist or the freedom fighter, because I'm sure the British looked at us 200 years ago a little bit differently. You know, maybe part of this whole thing is maybe we need to learn how to leave people alone and trust them to decide what their government should look like on their own. And sometimes maybe we ought to stay at home and let people self-determine. You get the government you want. It always springs from the people. This is Nick Begich, and we're headed for a break, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to this program on RBN Live, and we're on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time, and we've got a caller, Daniel in Wisconsin, has been holding, so we'll go ahead and take that call. Daniel, are you still with me?
Hello.
Hi.
You touched on it briefly. It is somewhat controversial, but it's believed that the supercomputers can scan the digital domain and recognize phrases or keywords so that those conversations can be further investigated. An NSA whistleblower, whose name I can't remember, said it exists already.
Yeah, it does, actually. We reported on it back in 1999 in the book Earth Rising, the Revolution, and I could look up the source, but it was a mainstream media report on the NSA, and it also came out of another report that doesn't get you know, here's the thing. A lot of information never gets widely circulated. There's one in particular, and I quote it in the book Earth Rising, and it's the European Parliament, and it's called An Appraisal of the Technologies of Political Control, and it's from their Technology Assessment Group. And it was issued in September 1998. And this was during the time when we were doing a lot of work in Europe identifying some of these technologies. And, you know, it's interesting how they would phrase it, technologies of political control. I mean, because Europeans who know what it's like to be politically controlled in a tyranny, whether you be Eastern Europeans or Western Europeans who remember World War II, people actually lived through it. So when they look at technologies and how they're being applied, they get into these surveillance technologies. They mention Echelon by name, the surveillance of communications, and they also talk about the voice printing and some of this other technology that's been around for quite some time. And you know, the only thing that's happening now is you're able to sort more of those conversations more efficiently, and because of standardization in communication systems, something that this report from 98 warned about, and it is making it even easier to hack through that mass of communication by computers.
I say never say Allah Akbar.
There you go. Hey, Daniel, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Again, the call-in number today is 800-313-9443. And, you know, I just read that the name of that document, and this appraisal of technologies of political control. And it's the STOA Interim Committee. It's an interim study that was issued in September 1998. It eventually became a final study. We quote that in Earth Rising 2. Again, you know, when you think about Europeans, they have been addressing these issues way in advance of 9/11. You know, they had their own terrorist incidences in Great Britain, in Europe, that they responded to. Nothing as massive as what we've seen here, but enough to respond. You know, and back in the 90s when I traveled to Europe, their security at airports was more efficient in the 90s than ours is today in the U.S. I mean, I travel all over the world, and I can tell you this so-called security at airports is really a joke. I mean, it's not what it seems to be. And so what's going to happen in this is greater mechanization, because the efficiency of that operation is just not there. And mechanization is where it's going. You know, the idea of actually looking and looking into a person and being able to review lots of things about them comes up all the time. You know, there's a new computer. This is from BBC News, and this is just released in a news story of the 26th of June 2006. So, you know, it's like a couple days old. And it's the headline is Computers Set to Read Our Minds. all right, where they can look at facial features and feature points on the face so that when you're walking through and the camera's observing you, they can actually determine what you're thinking about to a certain degree of accuracy to where they can, say, screen out a bunch of people to decide who gets looked at more closely. Because that's really, a lot of these systems are designed not to be perfect, but just to kind of push you into this generalized group where then they can take a closer look at you. And so it's that kind of, they used to do it with races called racial profiling, but it's a different kind of profiling. It's profiling based on data collection and based on observation. And when information is all tied together, again, you're walking through the airport, the camera sees you, it recognizes, A, who you are with a great deal of accuracy that is increasing, 2, knows kind of what you're feeling and sensing, and then 3, connects all that to your plane reservation and who you are, and because they've already done a background search on you before you get on the plane, which is permitted under this so-called paranoid state we call a terrorist fear that we're living under right now. So by the time you make all these transactions, you know, the government's already taken a good look at you and decided who they're going to follow around in the airport that day. You know, and maybe that's a good thing, I mean, for security reasons, and maybe it's not. But what isn't a good thing is to be doing it without a public debate like the one we're trying to have today, where people actually have the information and can weigh in on the subject. And we can decide how much of our civil liberties we give up. And then every time one of these stories comes out, like George Bush the other day is talking about the fact that we're monitoring all the phone calls in the U.S. as if it's new information to anybody who reads the newspaper. You know, the fact of the matter is he chastised the New York Times for releasing that information. He chastised the New York Times for releasing the stories on hauling people around the world so we could torture them. You know, the fact of the matter is a free press isn't just about saying what you want, when you want, how you want. It's about informing the public so you can have a political debate. Sometimes it means giving some information that feeds that debate in an appropriate way. Hey, this is Dr. Nick Begich. We're headed for a break, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. The call-in number today is 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443, and we're talking about privacy-related technology, and I'm using as my guide kind of today books we've authored and published, Earth Rising the Revolution and Earth Rising 2. You know, we were talking a little bit about, just before the break, this idea of technologies of political control and how the European Parliament has tagged them that way. They've also coined the phrase data valence, which is the interpretation of large amounts of data. They did this in one of their technical reports, which I just quoted from, where they really talk about the impacts of data valence in terms of populations. And this is the collection of larger and larger amounts of information and then using that and applying that to intelligence work. And the European Parliament has weighed in and objected to this since the mid-90s and then formalized that in reports published in the latter part of the 90s before 9/11. And what's important is when we wrote Earth Rising the Revolution and we started reporting on these technologies, which now are making, you know, mainstream news here 6-7 years later, is because we saw a very controlled, directed society being built around these technologies at an ever-increasing rate without much discussion happening around them. And, you know, the technology issues really do, in fact, dictate what will happen in the world in the future. I mean, if you think about what governments are powerful today, it's those that command the highest and best technologies. And in the future, that will be the same. And when you think about technology advancing so rapidly, you know, what makes governments are people, and people need to have at least a working knowledge of what these technologies are. And we don't have to have the technical knowledge to necessarily know how to build these things any more than most of us can repair a modern automobile. You know, we just can't do it. But we can still drive that car from place to place, and we can still drive our public policy from point to point. And that's what we need to recognize, is we can have an intelligent conversation about technologies. I mean, 50 years ago, nobody talked about lasers as an example, and today everybody knows about lasers, and you hear it mixed into conversations with every kind of human being on the planet because it's common knowledge. technology is advancing so fast, we don't have 50 years to wait till we have an understanding of technology in the common knowledge. We have to put it there by really engaging the debate. We were talking before the break on some of the things the New York Times released in terms of technologies and methods being applied by this government. You know, the fact is the press, it was about initially not just saying whatever you wanted. That wasn't what it was about. It was about having an informed public so we could have an invigorated public debate. And in those days, back at the, you know, back during the founding of this country, every city had as many as a dozen newspapers, and they were often called rags because they were like one-page editorials with as much fact as somebody could find to back up their editorial position. And they fought with each other, you know, the papers in those days for circulation and to invigorate the debate. Wherever people gathered, those debates were engaged and eventually worked their way into public policy. Today we have what's called, I call the neutered news. You know, there's no news there because nobody takes a position. They want to all stay neutral. Well, there's no neutrality in the news. And anyone who's ever worked around the news knows it. You know, the Simon editor decides who gets the story, who reports on the story. He has his own biases or she has her own biases. And the reporters certainly have their own biases as they go and ask the questions. They only ask what they know. And sure, they have the illusion of neutrality, but what is neutral news? You know, news without an opinion doesn't push an issue anywhere. It just sits there. A little bit of invigorated debate, I think, is a healthy thing, and it's what the press was originally about. Keeping an informed public, have a good debate, and then develop good public policy. Today, it's about manipulating the outcomes. You know, when you think about all these data banks and data collections, how is the data used? Well, the main mission is, for commercial interests, is, of course, to figure out your likes and dislikes. I mean, RFID tags that are going to go in all of your clothing because they're going to be so small and cheap. They're going to go in everything that you buy so that when you walk back into a store and you go through those towers that they have at the gate, they're going to know that you've arrived. And they're going to know that you're wearing the shirt you bought and what day you bought it and what aisle it came out of. And so as you walk around the store and pick different things up and they see that you're walking around the store picking different things up or your discount card has an embedded chip on it that'll have that capability, they will literally get a profile of who you are. As a consequence, how can you use that? As an advertiser, you know all the information you need to know to target that individual with a specific message that they will agree with. In other words, they can manipulate people through advertising much more effectively than they can manipulate people now. Now they kind of give the information and you draw your own judgments. But if they can only give you the information you want to hear, think about a politician that has 10 issues on his plate and one of them you really agree with. I mean, it is an issue you're hot about. And the other nine, you know, you'd light him on fire if he were in your front yard. You know, I mean, the guy knows because he's done his homework, which issue resonates with you. And so he'll talk to you only about that issue, sends all the ad messages, the literature that comes to your house, tailored for you instead of the guy next door. And what do? You vote for the guy, and then you realize that he only gave you 10% of the information, but it was the 10% you wanted to hear. That's the problem. Manipulation of data eliminates debate, substitute what used to be called persuasion, which is when people give you all the information, they have the debate, and we're persuaded by the arguments and the facts to make a decision, is replaced by manipulation, giving only the information necessarily to get a defined outcome. That is bad news. When it happens in the media, and it happens in mass marketing, and it happens in politics, and it happens in all of those areas right now, big changes that are not in our interest will take place because you can tailor the message and shape the public opinion. You know, in Australia, they even went a step farther, and they made it mandatory. I was there a year or two ago, and they made it mandatory that everybody vote, or you lose certain like driving privileges and all kinds of things, so people really vote. Well, on the surface, everybody goes, great, you know, everyone's voting. You know, well, you know, most of those people are what you call totally uninformed. They don't have a clue what's going on in their own country or their own neighborhood, and now they're forced to vote. So who's going to persuade them to pull that lever? Or who's going to manipulate them into pull that lever? Because now to run into national office in Australia, you better be rich and have every big corporation behind you to buy the advertising that you need for those little 30-second sound bites that'll convince the masses that you're right, like buying a Coca-Cola. You know, the fact of the matter is, that type of manipulation is going to wreak havoc in Australia and breed a much different government, because no underdog will ever win. No one with without a huge amount of money or corporate backing will ever win another national election, or perhaps any election ever again in that country, because of mandatory voting. Something that looks democratic on the outside, but without an informed and free press, invigorating public debate, without an informed electorate deciding what our governments look like, it spells tyranny at its best, and corporate tyranny at that. And when you look at the outcomes, and I think we'll be able to see them in a few years, we're going to see a much different kind of government, and we're eventually going to see a very unhappy population as a result of it. You know, this country is headed the same directions. You know, when you start to look at this, a directed and controlled society, this idea of surveillance, you know, the idea of a shaky border, you know, all of these things that start to breed fear and insecurity in people that make us think that maybe a little bit better security might be a good idea. We got to really evaluate, how is the information used? You know, who's responsible for identity theft? Is it the poor guy that buys into whatever credit system that they're involved in? You know, or is it the 5 or 10 solicitations you get from credit card companies every week in your mailbox that somebody steals and uses? Whose fault is it? Is it the guys who send you this unsolicited mail? Why aren't they responsible for what happens? Why do they want to put a micro circuit in my identification or in me to determine whether or not I'm who I say I am? You know, why don't you quit sending me unsolicited junk mail that results in the theft of my identity? Why don't you quit and be required, if you're going to own the technology, to safeguard my information and start making not just civil penalties, but maybe some criminal penalties for people who don't have enough good sense to do that? Okay, you know, we have another caller online. I want to go ahead and take that call. Marilyn in California, come on up. Are you there?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Baggage. I had a couple of questions to ask you regarding your subject today.
Sure.
I'm trying to sort of keep myself GPS-free, if that's possible, you know.
Right.
I know that if you have a cell phone purchased any time after, I think it's, what, 2001, you've probably got a tracking unit in it.
That's correct.
And cars?
Yes, all the new cars have it built in.
Now, what about a 94 car? Would that have a GPS tracker in it? Do you have any information on that?
You know, you might be before. You might be able to get some information on the brand and model directly through the manufacturers, because they try and hype that as an advantage. You know, if your keys get locked in, you know, they can find it, and they can check that against the VIN number to see if you've got that capability. So that was probably on the edge of the technology, might have even been before, but it's right on the edge.
Well, I'm holding on to this wonderful car.
Well, you know, and the other part of that is, you know, these newer cars are vulnerable to other systems that actually take advantage of the electronics. You know, to knock a car off the road today, you can hit them with a little bit of energy pulsed in the right way, and, you know, all those electronic systems shut down, so the car stops.
Well, I'd certainly be a candidate for that.
Well, there, you know, and these are even deliberately, systems like that are being installed so that if you don't make your car payment, you know, your bank just shuts your car down wherever you are.
Wonderful.
Right. The other place that they got, they were trying to set up a tax system where they tax you per mile driven to make it required that you have GPS built in your car no matter when it was made, so that you got paid proportion to your use of the highway system, which they already do. It's called the gas tax. You know, I mean, you know, it's just another excuse to monitor our movements and our business, and it's not necessary. You can monitor, people pay for the miles they travel with the gas they buy.
Well, I got a little addendum on what you just said, and then another question.
Sure.
You know, here in California, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they are now trying to, quote-unquote, the regional MTC, Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which is nothing more than an unelected bunch of globalist bureaucrats, are now trying to force people to have GPS trackers on their car for commuting across the major bridges, because what they're going to do is, if you don't, they're going to make the tolls significantly higher to go across these bridges. And I'm not sure if they've actually instigated that. I've got, you know, email alerts from these bureaucrats just to see
right.
what they're doing, and that's one way they're going to try to pull this off. You know, they
right.
try to get people, everybody, to have these tracker units on their car.
And this is exactly it. They prey on fear, or they try and leverage you into doing it. You know, there's and this idea of blanket monitoring is based on this concept of tracking because of fear of safety and security. And the other is for the future use of tolls. You know, it's a lot cheaper to collect the toll off a GPS number and, you know, pull a billing and handle things that way. It's cheaper for them to process. And so they try to find ways to force you into that pattern. You know, here in Alaska at one point, we had a bank that was requiring fingerprints, thumbprints, you know, when you cashed a check. And you know, they know me, so they never asked me for it. But I had one of my friends in, and I wrote him a check right there at the counter. And they wanted his thumbprint. I said, wait a minute, what do you need his thumbprint for? I'm standing right here. They said, for my own safety and security. I said, well, look, I don't need any safety and security today. Just cash the man's check, or I'll have him endorse it to me, and I'll cash it, and you don't need a thumbprint.
Well, whole idea of forcing safety and security, I mean, even airbags, which are proven to be very dangerous.
Yeah.
That was forced on us. And seatbelts, I had, since I started driving in the 50s, or in the 60s, I shouldn't date myself too much, I've had 3 accidents that were bad. All of them, if I'd had my seatbelt on, I'd be dead today.
Yeah.
I'd be able to crawl out of the car.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, so their safety and security doesn't wash. There's another thing I wanted to ask you. Is there any kind of website or information that you know that would describe to you how to remove a GPS tracking unit, say, from your cell phone?
You know, I'm not aware of that, but I know that it's required under federal law now that they be installed. I'm certain you have the right to take them out. You would need, you know, on a local level, you would need someone really familiar with microcircuitry to understand that circuit enough to know where that GPS is built in to remove it. But I would guess you could. They would still know general location just based on where you called from because of the interaction between cell towers. But,
oh, okay.
So even that doesn't solve it. If you use the phone, they can really triangulate your position fairly efficiently. You know, it's, again, you know, it's like, would they, could they? Yes, they could. Yes, they would. And yes, they do. And, and whenever they have the technology, they abuse it.
You know, when I'm driving, this is something I wanted to ask you about, and I've still got, my car still has a tape recorder in it, and I drive through certain areas, and the tape recorder is playing. I hear this, and is that a cell phone thing, or what is that? It's always in a line as I'm going down my hill, and then going down at the bottom of the hill, it's in a line. Does that have to do with cell phone towers, or what? Do you have any idea what
it could be? Any number of things. Interference because of the interaction of wireless communications with landlines and everything else, you get a lot of interference. If it's a coherent signal, one that's rhythmic or tends to follow.
It's definitely the same signal all the time.
Then it's a man-made signal. You're probably picking up interference and you're listening to a carrier, which is like when you dial through a radio station,
mm-hmm.
when you get the right station, that's the carrier wave. And then when you hear the station and all the information on it, it's on a modulation. So you're seeing probably a carrier wave interference, most likely. But who knows? You know, I mean, there's so much in the soup. If you look at electromagnetic fields surrounding the human body, in the last 100 years, there are now 200 million times more in terms of density and concentration of energy than nature created less than 100 years ago. So we pick up a lot of things on our sensitive electronics, and more importantly, and we've covered it in a past show, our own bodies react to these electromagnetic fields in both good and bad ways. You know, this afternoon I'm going to be substituting for one of the other hosts for a couple of hours, so we're going to be back on, and we're going to continue this same conversation because I know we're getting into the last probably the last 10 minutes of the program.
I'll just holler. There's rain in California right now, in Northern California, and it's the middle of the drought season. Just my last parting shot.
Hey, you know, all of it's changing dramatically.
Very strange.
That's it. You know, if you take a look at the programs that are archived at RBN Live, we did one on climate change and earth changes along with energy policy a while back, and then we did one on controlling the human mind and the kinds of technologies that are being developed in that area. And we've touched on a few of those today just in the course of this conversation. But those are all archived there. We're going to continue to do these programs and cover topics that we think are interesting, and hopefully they are to listeners. You know, if we're missing the mark on some of these things, let us know. But, you know, this is a good opportunity to get issues out there. If there's issues people are really passionate about that they think we ought to be covering, send me an email at my website at earthpulse.com, because we certainly want to make sure we're covering those very important
thanks
issues.
Thanks for being there.
Hey, thanks for being there. Thanks for listening. And we're coming up on the break, and then we got one more segment. This is Dr. Nick Begich and Changing the Way We See the World on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And please pass the word on and support this network. If this is a program that's useful to you, we intend to cover technology areas. We've covered a number in the last 5 or 6 weeks, and we'll continue to do that. Today's topic has been the subject of personal privacy and technologies related to privacy. We still have time for maybe one more caller at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. You know, we started looking at these issues years ago, before a lot of it became sort of the panic party of the current beginning of this century. You know, people are really whipping up fear and anxiety, and you know, all of these issues certainly are issues of deep concern, and we ought to be concerned. But gaining information shouldn't leave us powerless. It should leave us with the knowledge and confidence that we can still make a difference. And I think listening and supporting the alternative medias in this country are increasingly becoming the vehicles of choice. You know, people see the same old nonsense on mainstream, and very rarely do they seem to get it right. You know, the fact is, independent networks over the last 12 years have provided opportunities for dozens and dozens of issues, you know, for us and for others, to invigorate the kind of debate, the kind of discussion that leads to good public policy. And you know, some of the things that get covered on this program, not everybody agrees with, and that's the beauty of this kind of radio, is we can have discussion, we can get to the heart of some of the issues, get into peel back some of the layers of nonsense, and start to look at the details that surround really the directions in which we're going, and then begin to ask the really tough and relevant questions. You know, somebody asked me, now, why doesn't it ever make it into the media? Well, in order to ask the right questions, you've got to have the right information. And that's one of the purposes of this program, is so people have that right information. We can all begin to ask those right questions. This is an election year. You know, people are going to be around. Let's start asking them the questions of those issues that we're concerned about. But, you know, having been raised in a political family, I can tell you, politicians don't have all the answers because they don't have all the information. Get that information. Get it in a way that is comprehensible to them. Good documents are a good way. You know, we found over the years in our interaction with political leaders that if they get the facts laid in front of them in a documented form, they really will act on it. You know, we saw that in Europe. We were able to get resolutions that addressed many of these technologies passed because people would look at those issues. In the United States, we have that capability and that possibility. And as this year rolls on, we're going to design specific programs where listeners can get involved and maybe make a difference on the way in which some of this debate goes. So, you know, technology is both an opportunity for change that can be that two-edged sword. And in democratic republics based on individuals where government springs from us and from what comes out of the heart and souls of men and women, that's where we're going to make the change. And I think we need to get informed, let go of fear, and replace it with the kind of confidence that leads to the political changes that all of us are hoping for our children, for our grandchildren, for generations to come. And this generation will be the one that decides. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we'll be back later this afternoon, actually substituting, and we'll be back next week on Wednesday at 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. Thanks for being with me.